Documentaries.
Uh-huh.
History. Insights. Interviews. Chef's Deep Dive.
And welcome to Chef's Deep Dive, and we've got a brand new guest today. He's usually can be found on the big hit podcast Proctor Who. He's sponsored by Smirnoff Vodka. He's the delightful Craig Stimson.
I'm so excited, and I just can't hide it. I'm about to lose control, and I think I like it. I'm so excited, and I just can't hide it. And I know I want you.
Hello there, Cliff. Hello, good to be here.
How are you doing? Yeah, I'm not too bad. Sponsored by Smirnoff Vodka.
I am sponsored by Smirnoff Vodka, and they've already been helping me out a little bit. You know, last night with doing Proctor Who, they had an absolute bonanza. And tonight they've come in with their backup sponsors of Co-op Suave. Yeah, it's a good mix. You've got to have a variety of sponsors on things like this.
Yeah, it is. It's where do you have, like, the sponsor sticker? Is it on your arm? Have you got it tattooed there, or have you got a big Smirnoff label on your ass?
It's on my ass. Yeah, it says VOD on one side and cat on the other. You know, it's just in case people want to get hold of both. That gives them the purpose to hold on to, doesn't it? And the straw goes right down the middle.
Oh, here we go. Yes. Nice way to start the pod. Boom, boom. Well, ladies and gentlemen, today we're doing Craig's music. Not his own music, but he's got to pick
5 albums
which touched him in a personal way or just feels good for him. Yeah, we're going to listen to a bit today and hear his connection with it. That's what we want to hear, don't we? We want to open up that closet of yours. Let out some of those skeletons. Let's see.
Are you telling your whole audience that I'm a gay man here, Cliff? Are you just outing me straight away? I don't remember giving consent to this. My wife will not be happy.
I am not doing anything of the sort. Well, was it hard to pick your 5?
No. Well, yes, as you know. It wasn't. The first 4 were the easiest thing ever. I knew exactly which 4 I was going for, and I knew the artist. And then it's like if you said, here's your top 10, I'd have been fine with that because you've got this list of artists that you listen to that you adore. And I've kind of got like my little hierarchy. So I've got my god and my goddess at the top. Yep. And then I've got my kind of B-listers underneath. And there are a variety of those that I put in there, some of which obviously couldn't make it because I've got my god and I've got my goddess. And then I've got these others. And I only had room for 3 of them. So 2 came in straight away because I love the artist. And it was albums that have always really connected with me. And then the 5th one I massively struggled with. As you know, I have changed my mind so many about this.
I helped, did I? Because I just kept dropping other ones and going, what about this?
I know. And that was it. I mean, this 5th one was only finalised yesterday. I'd even sent my final list to you, as you know. And then it was like, you just dropped another conversation piece in about one of them. And it's like, do you know, that feels right from the beginning. It was one of my ones I suggested, and I had a friend over at the time called Jane. Matt, my husband, were like, oh no, Craig, don't go with that one, whatever you do. It's like, but I love it. And they're like, yeah, but don't do it, don't, please, don't tell those stories. And it was like, okay, right, oh, I'm not doing with that. So I found a sensible 5th option, and then ditched it yesterday and went back to it. So yeah, it was easy, first 4. Album 5 was a killer. I'll tell you, it was really hard. But I think it's worth it. I think it has worked out perfect.
I think that's what we want. We want to hear, not like, oh yeah, I love this album because, you know, I don't know, I found it in a bag in bin or something like that. We want to hear why it means so much to you. So tell us your first album and why.
Well, my first album it was easier. It was the first one that came straight to mind. He is my god of music. He's my absolute Adonis. So it's Howard Jones, 1-1.
You got the feet. You feel it, chick, that's from a source to a beat. You know I love.
So what was it about the album then? What was going through at the time? Was it at the time, 1986, that it came out? Or did you hear it a bit after?
Well, what happened with me was, one of the artists I'm going to come in, I'll talk about later on, I'm going to save them until way towards the end. They were my passion. They were the only music I really listened to. And I began to just diversify a little bit and listen to the charts, because I was a bit special, bless me, really, looking back. And my brother and his girlfriend at the time went to see Howard Jones in concert in Manchester, and it just so happened, it was for the Dream Into Action tour, the one before this, it just so happened it was broadcast on BBC Two. So I tuned in to watch it, hoping, never been to a concert and not realising how busy they were, to spot my brother in the audience. So there I was, watching for my brother and thinking, oh, I really like this music. This is really good. So then I listened to my brother's albums of Humans Live and Dream Into Action, and I did really love them. I loved them to bits. And then along comes album 3, and I was so excited about album 3 coming out, and it came out in October, I think it was, 1986. I didn't get it until Christmas Day of that year, because there wasn't lots of money in my family, and it was my Christmas present off my brother. Aww. So I had to wait months for this album, and the anticipation, because the only time I would have heard it, so I got the singles when they came out, yeah, and I heard it on the radio. So for me, it was that waiting for. I was a bit of a Howard Jones fan, but when this came out, I just leapt on it, kind of like overly starving for more Howard music.
Well, also at the time, you have to think, there's no Spotify, there's no internet, there's no YouTube to hear it. You had either whatever you could find on the radio or borrow from your mate's audio tape.
That's exactly it. So it was, for me, it was listening, and it didn't get a lot of airplay. All I Want did, that was the first single, but the second didn't need it. I don't actually remember ever hearing it on the radio particularly. Because it was on Wogan, he was on Saturday Superstore, all those types of things to promote it. And I was there, as you did as a kid at that age. Because what, 1986, I'm going to have been 15. And I was there tuning in and making little videos on my on my VHS of all his performances. So, and I got the 12-inch and the 7-inch. So the album, it was like massive. The minute it was there under the Christmas tree, I remember seeing it, and I was so excited to actually listen to it.
Did you have it as an LP, or was it a tape?
I had it as an LP. I had it as an LP, and it was amazing. And the best thing about that was, of course, you had all the... I'm a big lyrics man on most songs, so they had all the lyrics in there. So it was beautiful. I never particularly liked the cover that much, but the pictures on the inside of me looked brilliant. He had this hair that was kind of like... It was the big spiky hair of his earlier stuff. Yeah. It was kind of cropped short, and it was obviously dyed. I had it done like that. I copied his hairstyle later. And I got it done. I don't know if you're a footballer, Cliff. I'm not a footballer, as you might be surprised, but... Back in the day, there was in 1980s, there was a Manchester United football player called Clayton Blackmore, because it was his wife that did my hair for me as a favour. I never ever met him. He wasn't there when I went, but he's a footballer's wife. It was very exciting to go and see Clayton Blackmore's wife and have her do my hair. And I had to go to her because my hairdresser wouldn't do it. My mum wouldn't let her do it. That's a different story. So she offered to do it. So I went round and got this Howard haircut. I loved it to bits.
And at 15 as well, you're sort of at a period in your life where you want more independence, isn't it?
For me, though, I was a bit different, Cliff, honestly. I was a bit, I need the violin for this, but as a 15-year-old boy, I was still at school. I didn't have a good school experience in the slightest at all. Very, very heavily bullied, and kind of didn't have many mates in school. So for me, music at this point, I was just beginning, kind of like that 13, 14, to develop into a friendship connection.
But
it was very religious-based, because I was at a Catholic school.
Oh, right.
So I kind of began to find myself through joining the Catholic kind of religious group. And that was, but they were lovely. The teachers that led it, Mr. and Mrs. Knowles, they got married. But the way they did it, it was none of the kind of really strong Catholic doctrine that you might get. It was all about the kind of love yourself, you are special, which was exactly what I needed to hear at that age.
That's better, isn't it? That's like believing in yourself rather than something else. Yeah,
exactly. So this album comes along, and it's got some tracks on here. It's got a track on Where We Going. And it's all about how, education dumbs you down and it restricts you and it puts you in little pigeonholes and you've got to conform. So for me, listen to this. This is like, oh, genius. This is how I felt about school. This has held me back. And this isn't who I want to be. I want to be this person. And I just remember listening to it and feeling quite, I don't know, I suppose quite trendy. I mean, I know he was going out of trend at the time, but for me, it was like, I always kind of jump on the bandwagon, the ship as it's sinking. And it's kind of like, I was just getting in there at the cusp of his popularity, so I could talk about someone that was, you know, in the charts, which was good for me. So yeah, it was an album where I began to discover myself without any doubt, and I began to take ownership of something that had a little bit of status.
Oh, that's a brilliant way of this, you know what I mean, at your time of life, so significant. It's the times of your life where you remember the most as a teen. You know, if you try and remember back further than that, it might be, I don't know, some birthdays or some disaster in your life.
Yeah.
But at that point, it's quite crucial. 15 years old for me, you go through a lot of bullying, turmoil, fights in and out of stores, and I don't know, you know, your whole hormones are racing all over the place out there. Are you thinking, what is going on? I'm trying. You sort of don't want your mum and dad, but you really do want your mum and dad.
You need them as well. Yeah. Well, I remember the time with this, there was one of my friends that I was involved with, this kind of the Christian, which only lived around the corner. And she had an Australian friend come and visit her. And there was this kind of pseudo crush between me and her. Now, to be honest, I didn't actually feel a thing. But she clearly had this crush on me.
Yeah.
I was quite happy with that, because she told the entire school that, you know, I was going out with her Australian friend. So for a little bit of time, I had this makeshift relationship, which kind of bought me some status as well, because it stopped people calling me gay. And I suddenly had a girlfriend that I never did. And, you know, she adored me to bits. And we just, you know, we just chatted. It was lovely. It was perfect.
It's also making those connections at that time of life, which sometimes, if you're lucky enough, you stay with for a long time. You connected with this album, whether or not someone's heard it before. Listeners, have a good listen to it. Like I said, when I listened to it, I heard that little bit of snow. There's tracks on there where you go, fuck me, is it him who did that? And honest to God, I was like, whoa, is it him who did that?
Actually, I didn't realise that it had done so well, because it did get to number 10. And I just thought no one knew this album whatsoever. And the only time I ever heard one of the singles played was in a aerobics class at university. I have never done such a hard workout for 4 minutes in my life. I had to show solidarity for that, man. It was brilliant. And I was doing my little, I don't know, grapevines and all the rest of it in a sports hall, so you know I love you, don't you? That is great. Yeah, it's a really, to me, it's a brilliant album. But it was also, with this album, it was kind of a bit of a watershed moment in my family as well, because I was obviously a big Howard fan, and my dad hated Howard Jones. He couldn't stand him. And he used to always go, and I was like, I put Howard on the LP, because they're always vinyls.
Yeah.
And he'd leave. He'd have to go out the room when he played. Now, as far as I was concerned, there was nothing that wrong with Howard Jones that someone had to leave the room. And eventually he'd say to me, oh, Craig, I just can't listen to it. The man just sings so slowly. He just needs speeding up. He needs a bit of life giving to him. And I'm like, well, that's his voice, Dad, la, 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 all the rest of it. So they're a massive Howard Jones fan. My dad died just after this album was released.
Oh.
So he never got to know the bit that came next. So he was, you know, he was this thing. And then there I was, big Howard Jones fan. Bought the album. He couldn't stand it. And about, I got a job at Boots in Salford Precincts in September 1987. And there it was, on the shelf, reduced, the tape. So, of course, I had to buy the cassette of this album, didn't I? It was just like, I'm a fan now. I collect. It's what fans do.
That's
I've got the 7-inch, got the 12-inch, got the album. There was no CDs, obviously, back then. And I got home, right, and I tell you to this day, I put the tape into play, and it played fast. It was like, what the hell's going on here? This is not the album. It's at super speed. And it suddenly dawned on me that for years I'd been playing Howard Jones on the wrong speed.
No!
Absolutely!
No!
Do you remember the days when you had the little settings?
Yeah, the 45 or 78 and all that.
I was a bit special. I had it like in, it was probably not on 33, whatever, the complete song. I probably had it in between or something like that. And he was right. For all those years, Howard Jones sang slow because I put him on the wrong setting.
Oh my God.
And I couldn't believe it. It was just so genius. It was like, oh dear Lord. And of course, then I had to buy them all on cassette because I had to listen to them all. It was like rediscovering some that you, it's like the comfy slippers suddenly get washed and come out even comfier. Brilliant. Oh, it was absolutely fantastic. And it was actually the first concert I ever went to see as well. So it was like, for me, I had that double whammy. My album, me growing up, and then going to a concert. No way had I ever... It was like a big thing for me to go with my mates, be taken to Manchester Apollo to see Howard Jones on the 18th of March, oh. I think it was, 1987. Oh, it was just genius. Honestly, Chris, it was brilliant to see.
Brilliant album choice, and a really good change of the path of your life as well.
Yeah, it was, definitely.
So what would you say is your album number two?
Well, I'm going to go completely different on album number two. I'm going to fast forward, and I'm going to go quite a lot forward, actually, year-wise. I'm going to go to when I was working in 1998. I'm going to play around a little bit with time here. I love this album, but it hasn't got the same frivolity and fun as the others, and I don't think the artist ever could. It's Alanis Morissette. She is my absolute goddess of all time. I just adore this woman. But I'm not going for Jagged Little Pill. Everyone knows Jagged Little Pill. Yeah. I'm going for supposed former infatuated junkies. How about them transparent dangling carrots?
How about that ever elusive kudo? Thank you, India.
This album for me is just a really amazing album. And it's not exactly a dance album, is it really? It's a really dark, quite heavy album, I also think, supposed to form an infatuation. Can we just call it Junkie, actually, hasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I think it got slammed by a few people just saying, is she trying to copy the first one? Well, you know, it's been like, what, 4 years, 3-4 years since the last one, and that one would have took her a year and a half to do. So, you know, there's a lot changed in her life. And like you picked this album, 1998, a lot has changed in your life from your first album.
God, yeah.
So where was you at this point?
1998, I was working. I would have been teaching for four years. I would have been kind of slowly progressing up the career ladder. You know, I'd been with Matt for 8 years, so we were kind of well and truly established as a couple. But after 8 years, you know, you get those kind of bits of arguments that crop in and all the rest of it. And I think this album just fit in perfectly with loads of stuff because it's about, you know, it's about control, isn't it? It's about work, it's about expectation, it's about commitment and relationships and basically it's when people try to piss you off or they you off. And, you know, it's very much about your anger. And at times I was feeling that, you know, at the time. And I think that's what it was. But it's very, like I said, I see it as a heavy, dark album. And I think sometimes, for me, when I was in that zone of, this album would come out and you'd have those really heavy keyboard sounds. You'd have, a lot of my music isn't guitar-based at all. So you would have that screaming guitar in there or that kind of really heavy bass that comes in. And it just met perfectly. And kind of around this time, I used to get a lift in. We lived in Barnsley for a lot of years, and then we moved to Crofton, and we had to sell our car and blah, 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 to afford the house we bought. And I got a lift in with the woman just around the corner, who just coincidentally works at the same school that I did. I used to teach this time. Oh, she's still to this day an amazing friend, and her whole family are part of our family as well. And she just is completely bonkers to the point where she once got so angry with her husband, she fed him dog food and this, that, and the other. Just
oh my
so
god!
she's completely barmy. But she sometimes get in the car and talk about, I'm so angry. We need Alanis. And she shoved Alanis Morissette tape in. And the two of us would drive to work talking about men and how shit they were. And it was just absolutely brilliant. But that was about family relationships. It was about work. It was all the anger coming through. And a couple of songs in there are always about being true to yourself, you know, things like that. Yeah. I Would Be Good, which to me is still one of my go-to songs. You know, any kind of low point, I always go straight to that sort of one of those songs. And I just love it. So that's where I was. I was working now. I was no longer this kind of 15-year-old. I was 1998. I'm coming towards late 20s.
Yeah. So at this point in your life, I wouldn't say you know what to do. You sort of, sometimes at that point as well, you can get yourself in a rut. Yeah, I know I was in my early 20s. I was in a bit of a rut because I'd been in this job for a while and I thought that was it. You know, because, you know, sofa can be like more or less the center of the universe for some people, and they never move out of it and they live there and die there. So in this point, 1998, I'm listening to this album and I'm listening to a lot of angry stuff. And I'm just like a bit like, oh, I'm getting a bit down. And it was only a couple of years after this, I shot off and went to live down in London for like 5 years and went and just got a job out of the blue on my own and just went. And I also went traveling through America on my own for a little while as well. And I just thought, Salford, Manchester ain't the centre of the universe. And you listen to songs which more or less you tried to capture your anger, aren't you? So when you listen to it and go, you know what? Fuck it, I can still got a lot of my life left. I can do what I want. Yeah.
And that's perfect for this, isn't it? Because that's when you were saying that's exactly what it was with me. Because, you know, I was beginning to climb up. So 1994, I started teaching. I was a really good teacher and I was recognised quite quick and they promoted me. Well, they promoted me to a job that everyone encouraged me to go for. I didn't like it. I didn't want it. And for 2 years, I did this job that I hated and I built a lot of resentment up towards it. And this is when this album fits so perfectly in there about that kind of control and the anger and the expectation to deliver. And then they just changed me. They made me, instead of a pastoral manager, they made me a head of department. And I just loved it. I stayed at that school for like 16 years, something like that. I truly, truly loved it. But it's about not doing what people expect you to do. This is what I think she's saying in this.
After
Jagged Little Pill, they had this expectation of this fantastic, very creative woman, a very young woman at the time.
Yeah.
She was born in 1974, so that's, so God, how old is she here? 24? So 21 when she's doing Jagged Little Pill, I'm guessing off the top of my head. And she's kind of like, that's probably the similar age to where I was. I was a bit younger, a bit older than her. But I get what she was saying, that people were kind of pigeonholing to what she had to do and how many tracks of this type she had to have. And I had to do this, that, and the other. And it was just so nice to break away and do something different.
Exactly. Can you imagine the amount of pressure what she would have been under after the first album? It would have been saying, you need to do tours, you need to do this, you need to get another album out. And luckily, she stood by her guns and I ain't playing with putting another album out. Most people would have banged a live album out, at least, from a tours to fill it in, and then banged another one out within a couple of years. It took her 3 years to get it out. And, she's talking about her struggle with the people around her.
Yeah, and that's what I love about Alanis Morissette. Even to this day, she had a new album come out this year called, what's it called? Such Pretty Forks in the Road. And I love every single one. Honestly, I could put any one of her albums in here as a top five because I love every single one of them. That's what I mean. Howard and Alanis would always be there at the top. No matter which album, they'd always be there. They'd be everything else, hands down. So I just chose the one I connected with the most.
They're not similar in the sense of music, but they're similar in the sense of how they write their stuff. Like, Howard will write what he wants to write. He don't fucking care if it lands in the singles or not. And she will write whatever she wants to write.
Yeah. It's one of the things I love about Howard Jones. He says it to this day. He didn't care. He did one-to-one, and he says quite happily that he knew this was his last commercial album.
Yeah.
And the next album is deliberately called Cross That Line because he was like, fuck you. Wait, I don't think he's swear, but he's very principled. He's quite Buddhist in his approach. So I don't know how he'd be and things like that. And he's like, I want to follow my vision. And my vision is no longer charts. It's about my lyrics. It's about my expression. It's about my connectivity. And that's what I love about him. And if anything, his more recent stuff, you know, I just truly, truly adore the man and his lyrics. And I love the fact that, I suppose financially, it must be different for him. He doesn't need to worry about that, I suppose.
Yeah.
But more than that, you know, it could all have gone tits up for him, but he didn't care. He went for it, you know. It didn't matter that his albums didn't make that commercial success. He wasn't looking for that anymore. And the same with Alanis Morissette. She never, ever went back to Jagged Little Pill. She never met that kind of meteority again. No. All her albums have kind of decreased since then. But it doesn't matter you know, she still talks about the issues that are relevant to her. You know, control, emotion, expression, being yourself, the problems of motherhood, the problems of relationships. And I just love her for that. I just love anyone that talks about feelings that try to connect with other humans.
That's a brilliant way to describe it. And do you find that in yourself, you connect with that because you yourself like to do the things you like to do?
Yeah, that is very much about one of the next albums I'm going to chat about. It is just, I am that. I love songs and I love artists that talk about transformation.
Yeah.
That kind of, you might start off here, but you end up there, and it's the journey that counts. You know, it's about who being who you are. I've always believed that. I love diversity. I love celebrating difference. And I love the fact that you can't be something immediately. You have to take time to get there.
Of course.
And it can be something as simple as those that listeners you've got that have listened to Proctor Who, the journey that I've had trying to get together with technology. Something as simple as that. It's only small and it's not important in life, but it's still a challenge. It's a small one.
Yeah.
And you have to do it, and you have someone that helps you along the way. And that can be anything from relationships to music to interest, anything at all. And anything about transformation and being yourself is always high on my agenda.
That's brilliant. And that'll lead us through to, like you said, your next album.
So album number three finds me in a really different place. So we're kind of backtracking now almost 10 years to 1989. So this is about 17, 18-year-old Craig, and he's really... But he's a little bit confused, to be honest, but he's not at the same time because he kind of knows that he's gay at this point. But
yeah.
He's known for a long time, but hasn't ever come out. And that kind of volcano inside of him is about to erupt because he fancies someone and he's aware of it. And he just needs to say it because girls are coming on to him and he's not interested and they can't understand why he's not responding to them and all the rest of it. And it's like, I just had to explore. So along comes, I kind of got into this group in 1988 when I was at De La Salle College. And someone recommended him to me. It's Erasure. And I love Erasure. To this day, I love Erasure. Their albums are very varied, to be honest. Some are shit. And some are really, really good. But obviously, I'm choosing a really good one. So I'm going to go with their 1989 release, Wild.
Yes, I love it. You know what? I know this album. I know it well. And the reason I like it was I got onto Erasure from my cousin. He had... Remember they came back with like an ABBA-esque album?
Oh, I remember ABBA-esque.
Yeah, and it was tremendous. I thought, oh, wow. They really cleverly mix pop and retro music. And I was into... I like the disco anyway. And then you go through the back catalogue, don't you? And I found these. Yeah. And obviously Blue Savannah, which was a massive single anyway. And I love that tune. And then when you said you're doing this, I clicked the album and I was like, oh, yeah. I was singing Blue Savannah.
It's just genius. It's just fun. It's just right from the beginning. This album is just crazy. I love it. I really, really love it.
You said you was in college at that time.
I was in college, yeah. I was in sixth form now. So I was in 1989, I'd have been in my third year. So I'd have begun to get into, because I left there in 1990.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like in my second year, I was there for 3 years. I had to resit the first year because my dad died, as I said, just as about to take my GCSEs. That all went tits up.
Oh.
So I had to resit the first year, did all my GCSEs again. And it was then that someone introduced me to Erasure, who got Innocence out at the time. Now, I don't know why they introduced me to Erasure. I don't know if they saw something in me that I hadn't spotted. But anyway, there I was, and I listened to The Innocents. And I thought, oh, that's good. That's absolutely amazing. What a great album that is. And a bit like Howard, kind of like one-to-one, kind of like, I knew the album. But you know, you're desperate for something. I was desperate for their album, the new one, to come out, and along comes Wild. Oh, I loved it. I remember to this day walking in. I got it from Boots in Salford, where I worked at the time, and I got served by Alan. I'll talk about Alan later. He just served me this album. I remember going home and playing it, and I just loved it. I just loved it all. It's bonkers crazy. It's fun. It's camp, but it's got its erasure politics in there.
Yeah, he wasn't afraid to be themselves, you know, Andy Bell.
No.
Which is really good. Like, you know, there's two artists throughout the 80s who you remember are stand out, who just wanted to be themselves. One was Erasure and the other one was Jimmy Somerville. Yeah,
yeah, he was
and
one of them.
Both of them did care, and this is us, and this is our music. And when you're listening to it, especially Jimmy Somerville, I love it, love his stuff. And then you're like, oh my God, it's time to party. And they very cleverly was using the lyrics to talk about, you know, their sexuality, but made it in a pop, disco, fun way.
Well, with that, it's like when around this time, I was obviously, like you said before, there's no Spotify, no nothing. So it's all about tapes in the car and this and another. And I remember going out for let's say it was a summer holidays, maybe I was a student, definitely, so I was out for a day with my mum and my brother and the dog in the car, and we're going somewhere. I think we're going to some country walk, and we're driving there, and my brother said, what should I listen to, Craig? So I said, oh, let's put Erasure on. So I put Erasure on, and my mum was sat in the front, and she's clearly begun to suspect by this point. And she's kind of, I could see her mind ticking over, and she just went, I don't think we should listen to this album. I don't want to listen to this anymore now. Let's put something different on. Can we have some Madonna?
Oh my God.
From one gay I got to another. I was passing away in the back. Bless her, she never knew at all what she was doing in that sense. Not that she wasn't unsupportive. Yeah. She just didn't know how to deal with it. That's all it was. So it was just really funny. I always remember that, like you said about, you know, kind of like the lyrics showing their politics.
Yeah.
And things like drama. I mean, for me,
drama
that was just,
really good. Yeah.
I mean, who can get the word myriad into a song and do it so well? I had to look it up in a dictionary the first time I heard that song. And it kind of stuck with me all through my coming out, that kind of, you know, we all bleed and we smile, you know, a myriad of things that you can do, pick up a pen and paper, which is what I did. And it was like, that was my coming out song in many ways, because it gave me the confidence to do it. And this album is just, it's just fun, and I can give no more than 100% respect to Andy Bell and Vince Clark, you know, for doing this type of stuff, to be honest. It was really challenging, but people loved it, and I think that showed the support for the growing awareness, because it certainly was a long way from acceptance at that time of the gay movement and the issues. And as an 18-year-old kid, I needed that.
It's good to see that people weren't afraid to say who they are.
I remember when I bought this album, I remember seeing that on it, you know, Andy Bell credited Paul Hickey, his boyfriend, boyfriend would be husband at the time, would it? It'd be his boyfriend. And I remember being in awe that, my God, this man has had the dare to mention his boyfriend on an album cover. And I just loved it. It was like a massive explosion going on in my head of, this is who you could be, Craig. This is who you can be. Stop being this closeted man. Not that I think everyone knew you as gay, but it's about your own acceptance more than anything else. And just accept who you are and come out with it, for God's sake. And it was just brilliant to do.
Yeah, you picked a perfect album to help you with it as well.
It's really weird, because literally I've got to talk about you surround me on this one, because it's like, I still remember the day literally I came out, and it was a November day. I'd been with two friends that didn't know I was gay, and still don't. I've lost touch with them. I'd love to know what they're doing now. Anne and Lizzie. And we'd gone to watch in Manchester, is it Deansgate? There was a cinema there, Dead Poets Society.
Yeah.
Which I love as a film. And I don't know if you've ever reviewed it, but if you ever wanted to, I'd love to come on and chat about it.
Yeah.
And we'd gone, and Dead Poets Society as a film is about being you. It's about standing up and being anti-conformative.
Yeah.
And I'd been beforehand to buy the 12-inch, because I was a fan, that's what fans did, of You Surround Me. And I remember literally going into HMV on
Market Street.
Yeah. And I bought You Surround Me, the 12-inch, and I went and met Lizzie and Anne, and we watched Dead Poets Society, and my mind was like, ah, oh my God, I can't cope with this anymore. And I literally went home, and I put the 12-inch on, of you surround me. And I just put pen to paper and wrote my coming out letter to Alan at Boots and told him that I was gay. And it was just, I remember, and I literally, to quite an extent, I posted it. And bless him, he was just lovely. He never knew that he was my crush, but he was lovely. He was like, it's great, Craig, that's fantastic. But it was that song and on this album and that film that made me do it. Oh, I would have done it eventually, but that was just so, for me, motivational.
That's beautiful.
I always know you surround, yeah, it's lovely. It's a beautiful song.
And it's beautiful, like, sometimes you need to see what is, you know, I mean, whether it's, you know, a fictional thing on a film, but sometimes just seeing that it happens elsewhere in the world, that gives you that push, doesn't it?
Oh, God, it did. A bit like when I saw the video to Blue Savannah, which I didn't even have seen.
Yeah.
It involves lots of twisting around by Andy Bell. Well, me and my friend Elisa went to Andy Crane's brother's wedding. And I decided it'd be a really good idea to repeat the video on the dance floor. And I literally cleared the dance floor as I twirled around up and down. If I talk about it now to my friend Elisa.
Did you wear the white shirt and roll up your fingers as well?
I did, unfortunately. I still wear a white shirt now and send one of the communards.
Brilliant.
I love this album.
Brilliant choice and, you know, a beautiful reason behind it as well. So, Craig, you've topped up on your wine. Give us your fourth album.
Oh, well, I'm going to take you forward in time now. Okay, we're going way past 1998. Well, not way past, so we're a little bit past supposed form and infatuation junk. We're arriving 2 years later, the year 2000, and this is Kylie Minogue, and she's doing a comeback, and she's doing Light Years.
And what a comeback. Spinning around, spinning in my face, and I'm feeling like this.
Love this album. It's just, you know, I was always a Kylie fan, and for years, because here I am in my career, I'm back, I've ditched that job I didn't like anymore, I'm head of department, which is just a few of us, doing A-level sociology, and I'm loving it to bits, and I'm really in control of everything that's going on. And for years, I talked about Kylie. It was part of my everyday teaching. Any example I used in the classroom was Kylie Minogue, because it got the kids to laugh because she was so uncool.
It was.
It was like really bad. It was like, oh, look, because I didn't mind that. Look, they took the piss out of Sir because he liked Kylie Minogue. And then it's a bit like night. It's like 2003 when he talks about Doctor Who and looked at it like, oh, really? Yeah. It's like, here it is. It's like, here she comes, Light Years. And it's like, bring it on.
It was single after single, wasn't it? This album, this one, she was everywhere. Wasn't she? I wasn't.
Those gold hot pants.
In those golden hot pants, yeah. The videos were so stylish, sexual. Yeah. She was older now from her young poppy, you know, years.
Wasn't Stock Aitken Waterman. No. She's had a rebellion years, which even I've fallen out of love with her a little bit on, to
be honest. She tried a few different things, didn't she?
She did.
And also Loves as well, you know what I mean? She's in and out of Love. Did she go out with a guy in Excess of the 80s?
In Excess,
and stuff
like
that?
She loved him to bits and he committed suicide. That was the love of her life. What was his name? Was it? I want to say David Hutchinson. That's not right at all. Oh, I can't remember. But it doesn't matter, really.
Yeah, but like this one, she more or less grabbed the bull by her horns. She had a lot of backing with the producers, and it was everywhere. And suddenly, she was like the gay pinup, wasn't she?
She was everywhere. Like, everywhere, and I loved it. It's like I say, I remember driving to work from where we live, about 30-minute drive each way. And I would literally search the radio stations for a plane of Spinning Around, because like you said before, Spotify hadn't been released. I'd not got a copy of it on CDs in cars anyway. So So, and it was just looking for it left, right, and center, and it was everywhere. Every gay bar I went in, they were playing, spinning around. And I can't explain how excited I was about this album coming out. And it was all like, will it be a hit? Won't it be a hit? Because they did a massive release of the single before it was released. It was played for about a month or so before it was released for purchase. And it was like, will it actually just flop? Yeah. And it was like, boom, straight up. Did it go to number one? I think it did. It went really high. Whatever spinning around went to really high. And it was just the most satisfying feeling. Like, it was like literally watching, you know, the day after Rose was broadcast and the viewing peaks were 10 million and out comes Kylie with a new single and it's like number one or whatever. And it was just, I loved it. It was like that. Yeah, you know, she's back. She's the goddess of music. She's the princess of pop. She's just awesome.
And it was perfect. It was perfect for the millennium as well. You know what I mean? It was perfect for that time when it was like, wow, it's the 2000s. And then she came and then it was like
reinvention, isn't it?
I think she did the Australian New Year's Eve party or something like that. She was frigging everywhere.
She'd never had number one in Australia before, and this album tried number two and then climbed up to number one, which is brand new for her.
She'd always done better in the UK, hadn't she?
Yeah, she did.
Which was her home. Does she still live here? I'm not sure, but I'm sure she probably does.
But I wish she lived with me, to be honest, but she doesn't. Wouldn't be much laundry bill, would they? Because it's just hot pants and a little deeper in dress every now and again.
Is that yours or hers?
Which, I'd need to wash it first. I couldn't have my bits anywhere. You know.
So at this time as well, you more or less, you know what you're doing with your life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You've got your long-term boyfriend.
We're really strong. Yeah. At this point, we're about to celebrate our 10th anniversary, which I always equate this album with as well, because we had a 10th anniversary party and the DJ. I said, "What do you want me to play?" And both me and Matt just went, Kylie's new album. And that was our only instruction, that was to play Kylie's new album. And he played it so many times. And I remember them both dancing so many times, just spinning around and on a night like this. So, yeah, we were both very confident in our careers at this point, very established as a couple, very big and strong network of friends, both out and on the gay scene, out dancing, clubbing. It was just brilliant. It was a really... It's that kind of, what were they, that kind of how old, that third, late 20s, 30, really great time in my life, loved it to death, really enjoying my job.
And the big difference from this than the Erasure one is the massive acceptance for the gay scene as well.
Yeah,
it was
and
huge.
I accepted myself as well, which is the key thing. Yeah. You know, I loved the fact, I was not embarrassed to be gay, everyone knew I was gay, you know, I made no secret anymore, there's no hiding away, even though people... probably knew before then. I was Mr. Out and very proud, and I've always remained so even now. And the fact that this was accepted by everyone, and the fact that people knew that I liked Kylie, which probably meant I was gay anyway, was just even better as far as I was concerned. It didn't give a toss. And I remember going to see him in concert.
On the back of this album, yeah.
Yeah, I went to see the Apollo again. I think some cracking acts for the Apollo. And it was just it still is one of my most favourite memories of my life, is this album. And we went to see him in concert, and there were so many, it was like being, because Wakefield, where we lived at the time, it had a gay scene, but it wasn't a big gay scene.
Yeah.
And we went to see Kai, and it was like, oh my God, look, there are other gay people. There are lots of gay people here. This is ace. It's not just us two. There are couples as well, because this is all obviously pre-legalization.
Yeah.
And you were still a bit scared for your job at the time. There's no protection in your employment. So you kind of, even though people knew, you were always a little careful.
Yeah.
And I remember, and I'm not giving any hints away here, Cliff, but let's just say that the opening number was a Titanic track. And it was literally, there I was, we were there, and it's like, she's playing, what's she going to sing first? What's she going to sing first? We'd never seen Kylie Minogue, and we'd heard all the rumours, like lip syncing, and could she sing live after Stock Aitken and Waltz? And there were all these amazing, and I mean amazingly sexy, sailor dancers dancing around on stage. Yeah. It was like, where'd you put your eyes? The chest, the groin, the face. And it was like, literally, they suddenly, from nowhere, this fucking anchor just starts descending from the ceiling and it starts playing at one of the tracks. And off this anchor comes Kylie Minogue singing Love Boat. And he's just like,
no
oh,
way. Brilliant.
Do you know what he just think? If I, this is as close to sex as I am ever going to get from a musical song. I'd never seen Kaya, and God, is she small.
She's tiny.
And she was singing, she's tiny. She was singing it live. It's one of the campiest songs ever, and I just love it. And it was like, what an opening track. It was just, we'd never seen that material. Like, you know, every performer arrives on stage in a different way. But very often the artists I've seen have kind of just walked on. So to see such a dramatic entrance as literally hanging onto an anchor and singing a song is just like
fabulous.
Brilliant.
Absolutely. I love that. And like we were saying very early on, that when you go to see an artist, you want more than the CD. And they're doing such the theatre. It's a theatre piece. Even rock artists need to do the theatre piece. When they're jumping around, they're doing it, you know, to get you involved, get you moving as well. If you go to see stuff like Rammstein, they've got the pyrotechnics. I went to see Moby. He's got such a big laser thing. And Kylie, when she comes on, she's got all the dancers. And it's very, like, burlesque moment as well,
isn't
it? It's
very burlesque, yeah. She just varies completely. In this one, she dresses as an air stewardess and she's singing the title track, Light Years, as an air steward. And she actually did that song on this weekend. She did a live stream, Infinite Disco, for the release of a new album. She sang it again. It was great. But she has, you name it, we've seen her go round when she did the Aphrodite tour. We saw Kylie come into this big kind of clank into the audience, like a big V-shape that she walked round. And she was dressed as a goddess, carried by about 12 semi-clad naked men, and it was just fucking awesome. And not because they were naked men, that was irrelevant. It was just, how theatrical can this be? It was just, gee, they were obviously naked, they were semi-clad anyway, but they were all beautiful and toned. And it was like, this woman is just, she's creative. It's cheesy, it is totally cheesy, it really is, but it's fun cheesy. And that's what makes it great.
She always comes across as well as a nice, you know, read girl next door. You know, her interview is really pleasant. You never hear of any diva moments. I don't know if there is anyway. You know what I mean? When people like go Madonna, bit of a diva, can be a bit of a bitch. You know what I mean? Mariah Carey can be as well. But then Kylie, I've not heard anything like that about her.
I remember the first time in this Light Years tour,
it
was genuine. She was thankful because obviously her career was going boom, 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 going down.
Yeah.
And there was a real, oh my God, I'm here and you're here and this album has been a success. Thank you.
Yeah.
And it was, I know how to say that, but there was something that it felt really real. It felt amazing. Yeah, I've never heard anything bitchy about Kylie in that way. And I know the gay scene can be very quick to be hostile at times to artists. And never have I seen a bad word about Kylie Minogue, all the things that she supports. Yeah, Mariah Carey, I've heard about her. Madonna, I've heard about her.
Yeah.
But no, Kylie. No, don't get me wrong. Kylie's different to Alanis and Morissette, Alanis and Howard. I don't go to Kylie for meaningful lyrics. I just go for sheer fun.
Yeah, her stuff is just fun. It's party atmosphere. The whole family can listen to it, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So last year, we went on holiday with some friends. We chartered a yacht and we went
Look how posh you are.
I know. It sounds extravagant, but it was absolutely awful being on the yacht. And we got it at a bargain price. It wasn't luxury. It wasn't like anything. But anyway, there we were on this yacht and we'd looked at the captain, Rick Driscoll, and apparently he was a 70s and 80s pop singer. Rock singer. And I always devise playlists for holidays. And I'd put on it, obviously, Love Boat, because it would be, I always do with a theme. Put Love Boat on it. Comes on the playlist, and it's Love Boat. And Captain Rick looks at me, looks shocked, and he goes, whoa, wait a second. I said, what? He said, I sing on this song. And I was like,
no
way. Said, oh my God, I sing on this song. This is Kylie Minogue, Love Boat. Listen to the backing tracks. I'm on it. And then I said, I love this album. This is La La. I said, oh, I've got on here Your Disco Needs You, one of my other favourites. I sing on that as well. And I was like, no way. And I'm sat there thinking, maybe he's making it up. And he starts telling me these stories of Kylie and recording it, La La La. And he goes, we were told to sing this as camp as we possibly could. And it's like, we did the first record. It was like, no, stop. Camper still. like they did it. And I was like, I believed it. I kind of did believe him, to be honest. I had no reason to doubt it. I came home, got out the album. There he is, Rick Driscoll, on the thing. So it was like, I couldn't believe after all these years, there comes these two songs, Love Boat, Your Disco Needs You, a couple of others off this album that I love. And I met one of the singers that had met Kylie on it. It never disappears, this album. To me, it's been right through. It's just genius stuff.
Oh, wow. See, you meet famous people. The most famous people I've met is Baby Spice.
Oh, Emma Bunton, she's awesome.
I met her. I was dancing in the club and she was dancing at the side of me. And the dark-haired girl from Steps. Oh, she sat in front of me on a train once, but that is it. Right, and what we got now is your last album.
My last album is an absolute corker, and it stayed with me right through my life, to be honest, Cliff. I first met this album when I was 9 years old. I was just a boy. And how anybody didn't know I was gay at 9 years old is a complete mystery to me. I'm going with the original soundtrack to the motion picture, Fame. I just love this so much. It's just a brilliant soundtrack. It really, even now, it's never that long in between me playing one or two tracks in this album. It's just a truly genius album. And it was the first album I ever bought as well. So when I bought this, I went to Woolworths in Salford, and it was a choice between this or The Kids from Fame. And it was like, I've only got so much money, I can't afford both. And I went with this one because even though The Kids from Fame had Star Maker on and High Fidelity, which I loved and I knew, it didn't have the song Fame.
Yeah.
And I wanted the song Fame. So I bought this song, and it was the first album I ever bought. I bought it on cassette. And the first time I ever listened to an album ever was this one. And actually, that was pretty mediocre. I didn't know what to expect. It was like, I don't recognize any of the songs apart from Fame. I haven't seen the film.
It was similar to how I got introduced to Fame, because I remember watching it on TV because my mum had it on. My mum used to watch it, the TV show. And then the film, I remember being young and saying to my mum, oh, they've got a film. My mum was like, you can't watch that.
You can't watch that.
Yeah. You're too young to watch that yet. And you're thinking, why on earth is The Kids from Fame, is it too young to watch? It wasn't until much older until I saw the film.
I watched it. I can't tell you how old I was, because we used to go out to Auntie Barbara's Uncle Walt's on a Saturday night and watch films. And I think because I loved it so much, they rented it. Now, bear in mind, I was 9 or 10. My parents are very responsible in that way. I can't imagine watching it at that age unless there was a big conversation beforehand. But I remember watching it and thinking it was pretty shit and not really understanding what was going on, and at times being a little bit scared, to be honest. I remember
dark. It's very dark.
It's very dark, where Coco, Irene Carey, is, you know, kind of like exposed herself at the camera.
Yeah.
It's all about, you know, famous and the near-death suicide scene.
Yeah.
And all that. I don't know how old I truly can't remember how old I was when I watched it, but I certainly remember watching it there and it going over my head. It's like, I don't get this. But the soundtrack, however, every single track on here, I've watched the film since and truly adore it, obviously. And the soundtrack of it, though, is just a complete different kettle of fish for me. It's just truly beautiful. Every single song is a classic as far as I'm concerned.
It's a cracking choice as well. Like you said, you was only 9 years old listening
to it. 9 years old. And, you know, I was so into Fame. And then that, I'm assuming this is my last year of primary school, age 9, 10,
yeah.
Moving into secondary school. And kind of that stuck with me for a long time. I loved FAME, and my parents supported it to a point. I was allowed to buy a FAME t-shirt and wear, also I had the leg warmers, obviously, but I was allowed to wear the kind of t-shirt that I was allowed to wear. I remember going to Lewis's in Manchester.
Wow.
I know, it was a big moment when I got this. And I bought it just for FAME. I've had it since, the FAME red on a black t-shirt, which I love. I bought it a couple of years ago and wore it to an 80s revival and the FAME concert that I went only a year and a half ago. But my mum insisted that the dancers be cut off underneath because it was a little bit feminine. So literally, I walked around with a FAME t-shirt, and in the logo under the E had that swirl. And I had a hand from a dancer, but it was severed underneath. I remember that to this day. Like, oh, mum, please, it looks better with the dancers. No, the dancer comes off. And I also remember being very, very bad as a child, quite wicked. I love this song so much, but I also quite like expressing. So one day I decided to have some friends, and it'd be really great fun to recreate the taxi scene.
Oh, wow.
But obviously Winton in Eccles, where I lived, was not a thrive of taxis, far from it. So I decided it would be much fun to go to Winton Park. And what we did is we commandeered the bowling green.
Yeah.
And literally walked into the bowling green with like a podium. And I remember standing there. And there was me and my friends, and I was Irene. I had to be Irene. That's what I mean. How did anyone not know I was gay at 9 years old? And literally, I got my friend to press play. And up and down the podium, I slid and danced. And we danced all around the bowling house green and onto the lawn. And we moved the bowls aside. Oh, Jesus Christ. Oh, I don't know how we got away with that. I remember going home, and my dad said to me, "Pray, have you been at the bowling green dancing to FAME?" And I went, "No." I was like, and he didn't know where to go. He was like, "No, I would never do anything like that, Dad. I'd never embarrass you in that way." He was just dropped because he didn't know where to go with it.
That is moments in your life where you wish, you know, I wish you had a camera. You know what I mean? No YouTube back then, obviously, so you had no one with phones or cameras. You just went off for hours and just came back when you wanted.
I'd love to see it. I'd love to watch me as however old, 9, 10, dancing around Winton Park Bowling Green to FAME with my friends all doing the backing dances, and I was Irene singing along. And these completely strange onlookers thinking, what the hell is going on here? Well, someone clearly knew my family because they told my dad. I was like, no, it's not me, it's not me. I'm not into that.
One of the songs which stands out for me from this album, which I like on par with FAME, is Red Light. I love that tune. It's so funky. And
it's funky, that's the word I would use. It's just like you can feel your hips just beginning to twirl the minute it comes on.
And
they're kind of like,
and the bit in the movie just works well, and his dancing is amazing.
He's stunningly sexy in this. He's kind of like there with his tight shorts on, doing that limbo bit, and she's like there with a bubble gun, like, this is my own team. And it's like no, that is just, it's an awesome song. It's really, really funky, and it's great to dance to without any doubt whatsoever. And actually, it's just, again, just pure fun, isn't it?
It's pure fun. It's
almost like I Will Survive, Gloria Gaynor, in the way it's got, minds are kind of like, this is my man, I'm going to defend him till I die. You know, you step away, you bitch.
It's also a song where I think, I don't know who holds the rights to it, but you could really see someone bringing it back out again, because fit so well, with, like I said, with this disco funky, you know, with the club scene in Manchester is very disco as well. Like, it's all over. It's been all over Facebook on the lockdown. There's a lot of disco mixes out there. And I was like, there's so many classic tracks where whoever owns the rights to, throw another beat in the back of it as well. Boom, get it out.
This is crying for a remix, because it is really upbeat and fun and applicable the lyrics to any time whatsoever. And it's just a great track.
Whoever knows it as well, is you do try to imitate the dancing as well.
That bit, it's just great, isn't it? It's the rehearsal scene. She puts it on and goes for it. And you can see Lydia, who's obviously, she carries through, doesn't she, into the main series itself. Yeah. And you can see her looking. And it's just, I just love it. It is great. But I also love as well, and it's in the film, and I think they do it in the remake as well, Out Here on My Own, which is another solo track by Irene Cara.
Oh, yeah. Piano. Yeah.
And I think it's truly beautiful. I think I think I heard that a couple of times, actually. Played outside on the radio or whatever, just a standalone track. And it is really, really...
I think this shows her dynamic range, because you've got Fame, which is your upbeat disco. Out Here on My Own is very, like, she plays it with a piano, doesn't she, in the background. Yeah. And then she also appears on the end one, the main, is it I Sing
the Body Electric. Oh,
so,
God.
You know what I mean? And that's got a massive raise, because they use the orchestra and they use the electric guitars and the synths and the disco. Yeah. And Alan Parker more or less told him.
Gospel as well comes in there.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's all big, great numbers for an amazing soundtrack. It's one of those soundtracks where people's heard of the song Fame, but I implore you, listen to the rest of the tracks. They're really good. And it's very touchy as well. If you see the film, if you're not seeing it, get out and watch it. Not the remake, the old one.
No. Oh, do you know, earlier last year, not this year, the year before, I went on holidays to Gran Canaria, and only I could come back with three fucking fatal parasites of an infection. Not one, but three. That are all lethal, and I have to have all these whatever tablets and whatever. And all I do is, like, obviously I'm off work. I still teach a little bit as well as doing the B&B. It's like, Craig, you cannot do anything, and because they'd eaten their way through my bowel, my arse.
Jesus,
it's so funny for so many people. And it's like I just can't even sit down. And it's like all I want to do is watch Fame, but I don't own it. And it's like, so I go onto Netflix and I go through all my things to find Fame, and I couldn't find it. So I find the remake.
Oh,
shit. It's so poor. And then, bless him, one of my friends, Mike, found the original for £1 in the pound shop.
Oh, my God.
Just down the road.
Yeah.
And I bought it and I just sat and I loved it. It was great to read. What I've not seen Fame as a film for decades.
You know, and I know we touched on the soundtrack. Well, it can't be stressed enough how times changed, because this came out in the 80s, and it's singing about, you know, being abused. It's singing about coming out. It's singing about, you know, depression. And the film shows that, but it shows how much conservative America and the film industry's gone, because when you watch the remake, it's like a fucking Disney film. They don't show all the what goes on, and all of that is glossed away to like a Nickelodeon setting, and it makes you think, have we gone that far round again to become not accepting it's the dark stuff? What happens?
I'd not seen that one. When I watched it, I just thought, shit, but you're dead right. That is what is wrong with it. There's no grit to it. There's no real life to it.
Yeah,
it's all just very pretend and very, very, say, sanitized.
Yeah,
film. Whereas the original film is raw and it's dark and it has its highlights and it has its lowlights. Like Doris, you know, and the controlling parents, and Montgomery, the way he's teased. And then Coco, you know, with the abuse and the desire just to be famous at all costs. It is such an amazing film. And the soundtrack reflects that. It's so, I love the diversity of it. Again, like you, coming from Salford, I was 9 years old. I didn't see multiculturalism where I was.
No.
I didn't see gospel music was something novel to me. I'd never heard of it. I'd never certainly come across it as gay.
Yeah.
And it was like, this film just brought all this into my auntie's living room. And I remember being shocked by it and listening to the soundtrack and listening to, what's it called? The gospel one. Never Leave You Alone.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just, the scene is electrifying in the film when Leroy comes out and he's smashing all the bookcases down after coming out of the English class because you can't read. And it's just, it's so powerful as a piece of music. It's just awesome.
But I've noticed, this is touching on your catalogue of albums you brought, each one of them, if you look at the piece of the time of the artist, it transforms. It's all about transformation. Fame as a soundtrack, you've got the disco tune as Fame, which you appreciated as a kid. But when you appreciate it when you're much older and the film, it's transformation. You've got Kylie Minogue, you said you appreciated it, you know, all your time. But this piece, the album you chose, was the one which was a be-all and end-all. I'm going to give it one last big try. Transformation. She transformed herself again. You picked the second album of Alanis Morissette, which wasn't the major hit as the Jagged Little Pill, but this one was the one which she showed people, I am who I am, and I'm not listening to what you say. I'll do what I want. Again, transforming herself. Again, and you said with the Howard Jones, you always liked his stuff, but this is one of his last albums of commercial successful before he went, that's it, I want to be myself. So each part shows a good part of how you was in your life as you was also transformed.
I think you're dead right, actually, Cliff. That's like, oh my gosh, about psychoanalysis. Yeah, that is spot on, yeah. If you could, I'm actually wearing a Howard Jones album concert, which is called Transform. you can't do that, it's below the screen.
I couldn't see it.
You wouldn't have seen that, which is what's so funny. Yeah, you're right. I love anything about transformation, about improving yourself, being better, being who you are, and the journeys that takes you, like I said before. And I think that is reflecting a lot of the music I listen to, a lot of the films I watch,
yeah.
And a lot of the science fiction that I adore is about transformation and making things better for people in general. So yeah, you were dead right. Every single one. I've not spotted that in my album choices, but you're right, Cliff. Oh my God. Oh, should we have a counselling session?
I think this has been it, like a counselling session.
You must be exhausted. I've been 2 hours of me.
Oh, like, no, I could go on forever. Well, what we should say to the listeners out there that thank Craig for coming on, and as always, the people who have listened to it, he gets to choose a song to finish off the podcast. Now, the whole podcast, you would have heard, we've got snippets of the songs out of his the albums, what he's chose. Well, this is one of the piece for himself.
I just wanted something upbeat and fun. It's not an artist that I love any other than this song. And I wanted to go with a good old funky kind of pop disco track that is a get up and dance tune. And I've gone with Kelly Marie, Feels Like I'm in Love.
Feels like I'm in love. It.
Ooh, it's a heartbeat. Boo, 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 boo.
Anyone who doesn't like this song, Flavor Deck, the Closet Queens, that's what they are. Yeah, everyone loves this one.
They need to dance on, just let go to this.
Yeah, this is the shower song for me. This is it.
Along with the share track.
Brilliant, brilliant track. And thank you very much for Craig for coming on Shep's Deep Dive. Will we have you back again?
Absolutely, anytime, Cliff.
Bye-bye, Craig.
Take care, everybody. Thank you, Cliff. Thank you so much.